Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'm sure many of you couldn't get a wink of sleep last night after hearing this.
Puts up the shot, puts it in!
Yes, the Celtics did indeed triumph over LA in Game 4 of the NBA Finals last night. That tied the series at 2 games apiece. And I'd guess there's probably a dollar or two riding on the outcome of the next 3 games. And while, of course, we here at Radio Boston are not endorsing that because that kind of sports betting is technically illegal in Massachusetts, the Bay State overall seems poised to legalize casino gambling very soon. The House and Senate have put forward 2 different gambling bills that are proving how far the conversation in Massachusetts has shifted from should we allow casinos to how many casinos. Well, on the Senate side, their bill calls for 3. And this week, that chamber heard passionate debate over its plan, including anti-casino testimony from many, such as State Representative Matt Patrick of Falmouth.
We justify this with jobs, but we're trading those jobs for something. We're destroying families.
But casino supporters pushed right back, saying families are already being destroyed by unemployment. Here's Senator Jack Hart of South Boston.
If we were back in the 1990s when we had prosperity galore, we wouldn't be sitting here in this auditorium. The crux of the issue is construction jobs, long-term jobs, and revenue to the economy.
Casino gambling is just one of the stories we'll take on in today's News in Review conversation. So listeners, how many casinos and slot parlors do you think should be legalized in Massachusetts? Neither bill is passed yet, and the governor hasn't signed anything, but does this seem like a done deal to you? And if so, are you happy about it? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. Well, I'm joined now in the studio by Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's written for the Boston Globe and the Washington Post, and he's back with us here on Radio Boston. Welcome back, Ken.
Thanks. Good to be here, Meghna.
Also with us today is Susan Tracy. She's a former state representative from Alston-Brighton and is now the president of the Strategy Group. It's a consulting company. Welcome to Radio Boston, Susan.
Thanks. Excited to be here.
Well, Susan, actually, just let me start with you, given your experience up there on Beacon Hill. This kind of passionate debate, even though we've got 2 competing bills, for casinos, and who knows how it's going to emerge in terms of a final bill that's going to Governor Patrick. But what's been your experience when the people's blood has been this boiled on an issue and how it turns out on the Hill?
I would say that you should not assume that it's a done deal. There's a long path to get to a compromise between both branches. You clearly have differences from the House and the Senate. And this session ends on July 31st. Don't forget that. We have 7 weeks, and there are a lot of other bills pending. Clearly, leadership on the House and Senate side wants this to happen, but they're close but still miles apart. So we're not done yet.
And the very fact that the Senate had these hearings, whereas when Speaker DeLeo introduced the House bill, he did so by saying, we're not going to have hearings because we've had them ad nauseum in years past. Right. Does that show you that perhaps the rift between Senate President Therese Murray's vision and House Speaker DeLeo's is kind of getting wider?
I think it's less about the vision and more about the process. I think that, I was on the House side. I think that both branches like to try to one-up each other a little bit. And I think, she would like to say that they had process and the House didn't.
Oh, Ken Cooper. So, like Susan Tracy said, it's not a done deal yet, but we seem to be marching ever closer. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the comment that you quoted about the revenue picture and the state's revenue picture is changing public sentiment, and also I guess probably a few votes on Beacon Hill is true. It occurs to me that actually Governor Patrick has a lot at stake at this because when he took office, the very first big loss he had at the hands of the legislature was this casino bill, and Sal DeMacy basically slapped it back toward him. If he could get this done again, I think it would perhaps make him look a little better, that I try to get this done and I got it done. If he doesn't get it done, that could hurt him a bit.
And Governor Patrick himself, he was just over the weekend nominated as the Democratic nominee for governor again in
in the Democrats' convention that they held this weekend. Do you think he's looking at this as an opportunity, like you said, or potentially, you know, a threat, depending on what kind of bill comes to him?
Well, I guess it could be either. He doesn't like the casino business. I mean, not the casino. He doesn't like the slot machines. Obviously, he likes casinos. And who knows how that'll come out. That's a tricky one, too, because there are a lot of interests that are and political interests who, you know, like the slot machines at the racing tracks, which currently exist and are engaged in gambling. So
my sense from a political perspective mm-hmm. is that much of his base does not like this issue, the hardcore liberal base that he has. So if you're Governor Patrick, you want this issue to be something that is driven more legislatively than by you, and you probably want to have some quibbles with the legislature on it and make your base feel good about you.
So in that case, say he, I mean, this is theorizing, mm-hmm. granted, but say he gets a bill put on his desk that includes those slot machines, which he doesn't want. Is that an advantage or a disadvantage for him? Because he's got to either sign it or not at the end of the day.
I think it devil's in the details. Mm-hmm. It would depend upon it how it came to him, but I think for him to find some opportunity in this to push back on something that his base would want him to push back on and still get casinos is probably how I'd like to see it play out if I were Governor Patrick.
Let's actually introduce another little concept here, which is rather an important one, about these competing casino bills. And that has to do with some of the law enforcement issues that come with expanded gambling, money laundering, et cetera, because Martha Coakley, Attorney General, testified at Tuesday's Senate hearing about this. And she had been concerned that our current state laws, as they stand, are not sufficient or up to date enough to deal with, you know, electronic money laundering, for example, and added issues that come with gambling. But on Tuesday, she actually gave these two bills a thumbs up.
We believe that the respective gaming proposals have regulatory structures that work to address the various considerations that we have raised, such as conflict of interest, detailed background investigations on potential licensees, and much-needed government oversight to audit financial records, gaming machines, table game practices, etc.
So that's Attorney General Martha Coakley on all these sort of myriad layers of detail that such a massive piece of legislation holds. And Ken Cooper, I know you also wanted to raise a sort of a corollary idea here, and that is the fact that we have several Indian tribes who could be hosting some of these casinos.
Right. This week emerged a second proposal from a Native American tribe in the Commonwealth, the Aquanaw Wampanoag tribe, which is based on the vineyard. The pre-existing proposal was from the Mashpee Wampanoag from the Cape. Given their names, it's kind of obvious that they're actually related entities, mm-hmm. although they're separate sovereignties. And I suspect that some of our listeners are wondering, well, they're fairly small tribes and want to do the same things. Why don't they just get together and do one proposal? Well, the thing that people, I think, have to remember is that these are sovereign nations under the law, and it would be kind of like the difficulties of the United States and Canada opening an enterprise and agreeing to share revenue. Can you imagine how long those negotiations would take? So I think it's, you know, it complicates things that there are these two competing proposals to build a casino in Fall River. The mayor there seems to be leaning toward the pre-existing one from the Mashpee Wampanoag, and I would think that probably makes him likeliest to prevail.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've actually got a piece of tape here from the Aquinnah Wampanoag. They say they're actually ready, as you mentioned, to build a casino as soon as they get the go-ahead. Here's Richard Bennett. He's an attorney for the Aquinnah Gaming Corporation.
As soon as casino gaming is legal in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, any tribe that is federally recognized and has lands in trust can game.
Let's turn to a quick call here. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stuart's calling from Maynard. Welcome to Radio Boston, Stuart.
Hey, how are you? It's astonishing. I'm a native of New Orleans, Louisiana, and I moved to and they went through this thing. I've lived in Pennsylvania while they were trying to get it legalized against the Constitution. And so they have gaming parlors, slot parlors with gaming tables. They don't have casinos. It's corrosive to the whole process. You guys are going to talk about the political process. A gaming commission is going to be full of patronage, corruption, all sorts of things. The progressive laws about payday loan places are going to be loosened up because they're a revenue stream for casinos, mm-hmm. and if the state doesn't do it, there's going to be bookmaking going on and loan sharking. So they're going to have to do it because they don't want the loan because they're going to be losing revenue to loan sharks. There's going to be prostitution and drugs. Watch any Las Vegas commercial. They're selling gambling, drugs, prostitution on television. They're doing it. Watch the commercials. Bank robberies are going to increase, and it's going to be college students and cab drivers, and everybody's going to be scratching their heads wondering what happened.
So there's one voice of there's one voice of experience potentially against casino gambling in Massachusetts. Thanks so much for your call, Stuart. Let's sneak another one in here. Steve's calling from Easton. Welcome to Radio Boston, Steve.
Hi, I own a couple of apartments in the Plymouth area, and I think this will have a tremendous positive impact on the housing market. I find that when potential tenants show up to rent apartments, especially mine, which are kind of entry-level apartments, 9 times out of 10, they're people who are relocating to the area because of a new job. And I think if, for example, if the Middleborough proposal goes through and you get a Foxwood-style casino with something on the order of, you know, thousands of new jobs, that's going to bring tremendous impact. That's going to have tremendous impact on the housing market.
Mm-hmm. Steve, thank you so much for your call. Susan Tracy, in just the 30 seconds or so we have here before the break, obviously, as you said, many people across the state having a variety of points of view. Do you think that no matter what we end up with at the end of the day, that this issue will ever be laid to rest in Massachusetts?
Well, no, and I think it's interesting. Your two callers, I think, show the two extremes of the issue. I think both probably exaggerated a little bit. Maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Well, that's Susan Tracy. She's former state representative for Alston-Brighton and president of the Strategy Group now. We're also joined by Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. And you will have a lot more when we get back in our Week in Review on Radio Boston. Our phone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we are talking about the news this week. And with us is Ken Cooper. He's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, formerly with the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, Knight Ridder, St. Louis American, and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And one of these days, we're going to give you a radio award for being a regular on Radio Boston. Also with us is Susan Tracy, former state representative for Alston-Brighton and president of the Strategy Group. Now, that's a consulting company. She's with us as well. You can join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Obviously, another big story that's been happening this week that's been going on for many weeks is the continued oil spill, the BP oil spill down in the Gulf. New information just today about the fact that the oil spill may be jettisoning twice as much oil per day as we previously were told. Government researchers now say it may be as much as 2.1 million gallons of oil, gushing from that oil well. I mean, this is an ongoing environmental catastrophe that just doesn't seem to ever be stopping. Susan Tracy.
You know, I find myself thinking about this issue and thinking it feels like the hostage crisis. It's just, you know, which was spurred Nightline, so maybe you should do a day-by-day report on the oil spill. But it there's no end in sight. It doesn't end. It's not at the level of catastrophe of a Katrina or what happened in Haiti, where 250,000 people died, or the tsunami. But there just appears to be no way for it to end, and it is breathtaking to me that the company that caused this seems to be in charge of fixing it. And we're now on day 50, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm speechless about it. So it's hard to even talk about.
Ken Cooper.
Well, you know, I appreciate Susan's comment. It's sort of like a slow motion disaster. And I know early on there was some criticism of the media for not emphasizing enough the crisis nature of this. And that's one reason. I mean, you know, oil leaking is really making really dramatic photographs. Not really. I think it once again says, you know, the limits of our technology and how perhaps we have too much faith in technology to solve all our problems, or even in this case to define the extent of problems, which is kind of amazing given all of our technical capacities within government or within this particular company. I think personally, I know that there's some people who disagree with this, but when this is all said and done, BP will probably be out of business and be bankrupt.
Oh, you think so?
Oh, I think that, you know, the scale of their liability and how it's likely to grow and go on forever is going to make it very difficult for this company to survive in its current form, even though they made that $17 billion last year. I just think that, you know, you talk about loss of income to fishermen, that's lost every year. For how long? Do they have to be made whole?
It's a pretty daring prediction based on the fact that they're the third largest oil company in the world, if I understand, behind ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell. So.
I seem to remember when General Motors was the largest corporation in the world, too.
Well, you know, I do want to note, actually, that NPR reported more than a week ago that independent researchers had estimated the spill was way worse than BP was saying, and some of those more accurate estimates were coming right from here at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Uh-huh. They, back in May, said that it may be 25,000 to 50,000 barrels a day. That was the high end of their findings in terms of how much oil is coming out of the ground there below the water. It turns out that that may be the accurate estimate. So some Massachusetts minds looking at what's happening.
And actually, the Woods Hole people participated in this latest estimate, so maybe this is a case of somebody finally listened to them.
Yeah.
Don't you find that what's really amazing about it is most disasters happen and then are corrected. This is a disaster that doesn't end. Hurricanes end, tsunamis end, earthquakes end, you know, volcanoes erupt and stop. This, you know, even the ash cloud is over for a while at least. This doesn't end.
And this is another one of those disasters that not only is it not ending, but I think its tentacles are also spreading. Because I was reading today that now maybe in Great Britain there's some backlash against American criticism of BP. because BP is such a huge company that a lot of British pension funds are invested in. They don't like the fact that the stock value of the company is tanked by 40% or so. So there's that ongoing sort of political and economic
don't see a lot of sympathetic ears, huh? On this side of the pond for that.
Yeah,
well, I can't imagine that if ExxonMobil or one of our oil companies was spilling this amount of oil in the North Sea, that there would be no anti-Yank talk in the British Isles. So if we were doing the same thing to their waters, we'd be getting the same sort of pushback.
Yeah, so there's always that worry about that special relationship, but I also noted that President Obama, spokespeople from the White House said, this is not about the relationship between the United States and its closest ally. It's actually about the United States and a private company. So it fascinates me how as this goes on and becomes more unending, people are feeling in very different ways how it's having an impact on their life, even though the oil it may be spilling down in the Gulf. Let's take a call here. Connor is calling from Somerville. Welcome to Radio Boston, Connor.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. My comment is just that to echo something your guest said, it seems BP is still making the calls. And President Obama did say recently, you know, he's giving the direction and BP is executing on whatever direction, you know, the White House and his administration is giving. But that's simply not true. We have entrepreneurs down there who are pitching ideas to BP every day, and they're told that it is BP's decision and they don't want to go with the idea just yet. And it's all because it's a cost issue in the end. They're trying to really, you know, they're struggling with the cost, and the stock price is struggling with it. And as long as it's BP's decision, it's going to be based on cost. They're a for-profit company, and until that changes, I don't think we're going to see an adequate response. We've turned away help. We don't have, you know, everyone who's got capacity down there hasn't been put to work yet. And unless it changes, I don't think that's it's going to fix.
Hey, Connor, let me just ask you a quick question here before we let you go. Do you want President Obama to just really get in there more and take control of the situation more than he can? Because there's a lot of people who said that the government just doesn't possess the technical expertise to be able to cap a well that's 5,000 feet below the water.
Well, they don't possess the technical expertise, but I think that there's got to be, I mean, I don't know all the legality behind it, but they've got to be able to have some leverage to say, you know what, BP, you can't turn away ideas anymore. BP said recently that their singular focus, their singularity right now is on, you know, containing the spill itself. and not cleaning up surface oil. So a few different companies that have come out with organic, like all natural dispersants for oil, you know, their products aren't being used right now because that's not where BP's focus is.
Connor, thank you. Sorry.
Tells me that they're not throwing everything they can at it. And
Connor, looks like we lost you, but I want to say thank you so much for your call. Ken Cooper, if I can turn to you, there's something inside Connor's call that actually caught my attention, and that's about President Obama's leadership, because the other thing that came up this week is, you know, people accusing him of not being angry enough at BP. And, you know, if I can say, like, here's a man in the form of our president who may have spent his entire life trying to not be, quote, the angry black man, right? And he's also said this week, he's still looking for whose backside to kick now. So is this a dilemma that the president is personally facing in this disaster in terms of how emotional to be? And I'm asking you because also there's been some reporting, some commentary this week, say, in the Boston Globe about the transformation of Governor Deval Patrick into a new kind of governor for Massachusetts. So,
and this is actually a question in the case of both the governor and the president I've thought about and written about some. And I think the fact of the matter is that in terms of their character, not just their behavior, is that they're not the kind of guys who are going to get angry and without sort of summoning up that kind of emotion. It's just not the way they function. And quite frankly, I have my questions about whether a African-American man who was actually prone to anger, sort of a Jesse Jackson-type character, would actually appeal to white voters enough to get elected to either one of these jobs. So it's sort of what, you know, the constraints of the electorate and the kind of black politicians that have broad appeal produce these kind of characters. That said, I am always a bit pleased when either one of them actually do put that on. I thought the facial expressions of the governor at the convention that showed a sense of conviction. I used to always want to tell him, say, you know, show me from the south side of Chicago, which I guess could apply to the president, too, as well. And, you know, his quote about backsides was obviously something that was planned and you know, set for effect. That said, I mean, when the caller says that, you know, they're not using everything at their disposal, there's organic dispersants and this. I mean, all of this is experimental, basically, because there's never been a leak so far underneath the ocean before that everything is tried is pretty much an experiment. So you've got to have somebody who decides which ones you will try and which ones you experiment with. If it wasn't BP, the government doesn't have the technical skill to do it, I don't think. Perhaps the government should guide them a bit more, but I think it's a tough, because in the end, you want somebody to be responsible for the calls made, whatever they are.
Mm-hmm. Susan Tracy, if I may ask you, I mean, Ken Cooper was talking about maybe seeing a little more of the south side of Chicago in the form of Governor Patrick this weekend at the Democratic convention here in Massachusetts. Is that something that you were speaking earlier about Patrick's base in the state that you think they might appreciate seeing here?
I think a few things. One, I think people don't appreciate when you're fake. And I think the whole kick butt seemed totally orchestrated than fake.
That was from Obama, just to
that
be
was,
clear.
Correct. That was from Obama. And I felt it didn't feel real. So it's one thing to have people tell you to be angry. It's another thing to really feel it and be it. So I think you have to be real or it's going to turn people off. And secondly, on this issue, I agree that we don't have the technical expertise. I do think people need more leadership from the White House on this. And I think, sadly, probably what happened from a political perspective was everybody at the beginning of this said, we don't want to own this disaster. Mm-hmm. Let BP go out in front because we can't win, so let them take the fall. Of course, you know, now that we're almost into mid-June, we're taking the fall because we didn't lead at the front end because we walked away. So I think you have to be real. You can't be a fake because people feel fake.
Mm. Well,
the other thing I would say about that, I mean, and it's sort of more contextual, is that, you know, I think it is useful to remember that the president has so much on his plate any president. I mean, the two wars, the chugging, struggling economy, and now the biggest environmental disaster probably this country has known.
Yeah, I mean, what's next?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, how many messes does he have to clean up?
Right. Well, on the other hand, he is the president of the United States, though, so there's a big bully pulpit that he could be preaching from. The other difference I was thinking is that Governor Patrick had a minor disaster to deal with in terms of the boil water order we had a while ago.
Yeah.
He showed leadership there, but on the other hand, it was a quasi-state agency that he was dealing with, in the MWRA, so he could actually get in there and say, let's do this thing.
And it was resolved very quickly, which made a big difference. If that had gone on for a few weeks, who knows how people would have felt.
Well, I wonder if we could just turn a corner a little bit and look to something that's actually happening beginning this weekend, because tomorrow is the 40th Gay Pride Parade in Boston, and the city's gay residents have been marching and celebrating their community annually since 1970. How time does fly. A lot has changed for the GLBT folks here in Massachusetts since then. And Grace Sterling Stoll, she's the executive producer of Bagley, the Boston Alliance of GLBT Youth. And she spoke at a Pride panel discussion in the Theater District just last night. It was called Riots to Rights, 40 Years of Progress.
I was born in 1957, so I'm 53 this year. And in the 60s, they called me a sissy. In the 80s, I was a drag queen. And in the 90s, I was transgender. In this last decade, the OOs, I identify as a woman, and now I'm just Grace.
So Susan Tracy, Grace being just Grace today, just another woman in Boston, it seems to kind of almost raise the question, do events like the Gay Pride Parade even matter anymore in this community here?
It's funny, you know, when reflecting on it for this, I thought, one, how far we have come. Every major politician will march in the Gay Pride Parade and want to be there. We have gay marriage in our state. You know, gay families are very accepted and just part of the culture of our state. And what incredible progress over a very, very short period of time. And then I look at the Pilot editorial the other day where someone wrote a story about how he wouldn't want his kids to go to school with someone with gay parents and how kids are going to bring pornography into school if they have gay parents. And I think about if you're married, you have no federal benefits if you have a partner. And I think we still have a long way to go, so let's keep marching.
Ken Cooper, your thoughts on, at least in terms of what it means for the gay community to have come to this point in Boston?
One of the things I thought about is I thought back, you know, when you say 40 years ago, that was 1970, and I thought about how racially polarized this town was about then. And in some ways, I think the gay rights movement was one of the leading levelers that sort of brought people together across races. And in a way that we sort of take for granted now, but back then were groundbreaking, where you had blacks and whites who were gay, who made this expression public expression about what they had in common, whereas you had black and white folks otherwise who were at each other's throat about what they didn't share in common in this town for a long time. So I think that may have been important, actually, to healing this community in ways we don't give it credit for. On the school thing, the Catholic school, and I think it's such a shame that whatever somebody might think about from a religious point of view, to blame children or assign responsibility to penalize children for things that adults do that they don't have a role in, it's sort of ridiculous to kick kids out of school because
here you're speaking
parents.
About the Catholic school in Hingham that decided to revoke a child's admission because he had lesbian parents.
Right.
Yeah. You know, we're actually going to take a much closer look at this on Radio Boston next week on Monday, kind of raising this question about whether or not Boston is a post-gay city. And if so, what does that mean and what's lost and what's gained? So
semi-post.
Well, looking forward to your input on that, Susan Tracy, next week. So stay tuned for that. But before we go, it's time for our weekly hubbub, the one story from the week that maybe wasn't front page news but caught your attention. So Susan Tracy, if we could start with you.
Well, we talked about casinos at the front end, so I thought I'd talk about a lottery that is happening next week that a lot of people might be interested in. On Monday, you probably already know about this, there are going to be 179 low-number license plates. They're being auctioned off by the RMV. Last year, 6,000 people went for the plates, so you too can enter if you missed it.
Low-number plates passion
very,
in Massachusetts.
Very big for some people.
I'll never understand that. Ken
Me
Cooper,
either.
Your hubbub.
Well, today marks the start of the World Cup soccer tournament in South Africa, and the first game pitted Mexico against the whole South Africa. And one of my observations is that I think sports writers was maybe underestimating the impact of playing at high altitude. And both of these teams, Mexico and South Africa, are accustomed to that. And I think you might want to watch them a little more carefully, particularly Mexico, which has a talented team and has never won the World Cup.
Wow, and they had 1-1 draw today, South Africa and Mexico. So great start to the tournament. I am actually also going to turn to sports because we did mention Game 4 in the Celtics last night. And this was on the front page, but it's just I'm cheating and doing a front page hubbub. But on the other hand, it was just such a wonderful moment because Nate Robinson and Glenn Big Baby Davis, usually on the bench, they come off the bench to score 30 points for the Celts. And actually, they seem kind of amazed by their own performance.
Yeah.
And we have a little bit of tape here from a post-game interview because there was that one very intense play in the game where Davis screams and slobbers all over half court because he's so amazed that he just made this
drool.
Shot. The drool and the intensity and the wild-eyed look. So here's both Nate Robinson and Glenn Big Baby Davis reacting after the game to that moment.
When you're in the moment, you're in the moment now.
Yeah.
So if I slobber, snot, spit, please excuse me. Kids don't do that, you know, have manners and things like that. So,
damn,
yeah,
you
feel that?
We're like Shrek and Donkey.
Shrek and Donkey, at least Shrek's the right color, right? So that's my hubbub for the day. The Celtics, good luck to them in Game 5 coming up. And I also want to thank my guest, Susan Tracy, former state representative for Alston and Brighton, and president now of the Strategy Group. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
And Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, formerly with The Globe, The Washington Post, and many others, and now our own Radio Bostonian. Thank you so much, Ken.
Hi, thank you.